Anthony.
Hi, I'm Tony, I'm an addict. It's fine. And it's nice, thanks Dean for asking me to share, and thank you for your chair, and it was just what I needed to centre me. And I'd just like to welcome anyone who's new to NA, if you're new to the meetings, and we'd just like to say, look, you're not joining a cult, and you're not going to be brainwashed, and you can leave here at any time. And so it might, when for me anyway, when I came around, it looked like everyone was friends of friends, and it was one big gang, and there was me on the outside, and I've just been fortunate over the years, and like most people that stay here, you build and develop friendships in NA. So I just want to say, don't try not to let that intimidate you if you are new around. And it's quite a big chair on a Friday night for me when I'm knackered after a day's work, but I'm sure I'll manage. I've done chairs here before, and I did one a couple of years ago, and they had to, you know, stop me, and I was joking with Dean, I'd only got to about 1979, and I thought I'd better speed this up a bit. And then I came another time, and I just dried up. I'd been working really, really hard all day, and I just dried up. So I thought, oh, if ever they ask me back again, I'll be ready. And I was quite happy the last time I spoke. I think I covered a lot. A bit about myself and addiction. I come from a London Irish family. I was addicted to fantasy from childhood. I found reality sucked. I found it really hard to deal with. I am in recovery. I know I have two chains of thought that I can go off on. I can go off on fantasy, you know, what if. And I have this other part of me that's negativity. So I've been checking that recently. You know, here we go again, Tony, fantasizing, or here we go again, you're being really, really negative. I go to meetings regular because I need maintenance, and I need to connect with you guys. Meetings are great when we're all in here together, and we've got that kind of power of recovery. But when you go home, or when you're on your own, and you can be at home with your wife or spouse or partner, and or your dog, and you can still, you know, that's for me at the times that I have to, my stinking thinking can come in, you know. So I really thought when I came round that it was just simple. I just stopped using grade A drugs. And NA is a nice thing, you're nice people, you know, but I'm going to take the best bits of it, and I'm going to carry on using, but not grade A's. So I did come in with an attitude, and I did come in, I was quite angry that my drugs didn't work for me anymore. They got me through a lot, really, and I When I came here, I just had an attitude, you know. I'd just sit there like that, and I'd look at the differences, and I felt like what I was saying, it's all a big gang. And when I came round, it was everyone was in a meeting with a file of facts. They didn't have mobile phones then, and I just thought, don't they know who I think I am? Don't they know the people that I know? And you know, I don't need to try and fit in with these people. And I just really made it difficult for myself. I'd heard about NA through detox, and if you give me a little bit of information, I add the rest in my head. I remix it all and I add the rest. And so I'd gone from, oh, it's a religious cult, to they all hold hands and do kumbaya, and or it's social workers. But I was still intrigued, because I'd started to see people that I'd used with who were in a dreadful state get their lives back together, and they were clean. And there was one guy in particular, a dear friend of mine, he died to cancer, 45, clean, about 12 years ago. And he was one of them addicts that I couldn't manipulate, or I couldn't have one over on him. And he disappeared for a while, and I was a bit relieved, because even when I used to score for people, you know, they would drive me somewhere and I'd park them about three roads away so that no one could see where I was going, so I could get to my dealer. I didn't want them to know where my dealer was. And obviously I'd get a little bit off them, and then I'd take a bit myself, you know, all that shit. And he's the sort of addict that would have been like spying on where I've gone, you know, that sort of thing. And anyway, so he disappeared. And then one day I rock bottomed in West London in Shepherd's Bush, and I'm walking across the green and the van's pulled up, and he's jumped out of the back of the van and he was delighted to see me, and he came up and gave me a big hug. And part of me was thinking, you know, he's going to want me to score for him. And what it was, he said, "Tone, I'm doing NA, you've got to come, it's great, it's a great thing." And he looked, you could see it in his eyes, you could see the life was back in him and there was hope and joy. And but for me, I was still busy using. I still was on a mission of self-destruction and thinking that I'm looking after myself. And I was really happy for him. And I was really happy to have him out of the way. Like, okay, I can carry on now, ducking and diving and doing what I do. So that was another little bit of NA. I hadn't been anywhere at that time for about 5 years. And I said, do you go out? I was a younger man then. I said, do you go to clubs and that? He went, yeah, we do the Limelight. We've got NA DJs there. And there used to be a big club on Shaftesbury Avenue. And one of my early addictions was music. I loved music. I would just switch off to music. So I just, you know, my life just felt hopeless, and I knew I was going to prison. And I, the first amends I looked at when I got clean was the people that I loved, my family. You know, they came first, and to get back in the fold with my family. But then I just thought, I was still a young man, and I thought, I want to go to gigs again. I want to, you know, go out and dance, or I want to go on holiday. That sort of, you know, I was just missing a life that when I was younger, the drugs had just taken over. But basically, the London borough of Hammersmith and Fulham became my Bermuda Triangle. I couldn't get out of it. And I'd go to the dealers, or I'd go to the chemist, I'd go home, I'd use, I'd get my money, I'd go back out the next day, Groundhog Day, every day, every day. So me still thinking that I was having a good time, I was still chasing the first time I'd taken heroin, basically. I know it's not about different drugs. It's not, you know, but my denial was that heroin and cocaine is what messed me up. So this is what I'm saying. When I came to NA, I thought I'll take the best bits of it, but I think it's really, really extreme to give up drinking. And I think it's really, really extreme to give up having a spliff every now and then. And I think it's really extreme to, like, not take speed if you need to be up a bit, you know? And I call them social, I call them social drugs. When I came into NA, I knew the powders had fucked. I'm not meant to swear, am I? Had messed me up. So my first 90 days, I used every day. I didn't use grey days, but I used every day. And I used to leave meetings early, in them days the off licence used to close at 9:30, and people used to invite me out for coffee and everything with their filo faxes, and, you know, write down numbers. They didn't have the mobiles, and I just said, I've got to be somewhere. I hadn't been anywhere for years, and then I invented a job. I'm working nights, so I've got a night shift job. So I had to leave the meeting to get down the office to get me to sleep. So I wasn't really taking NA seriously enough. And like I say, I didn't follow the suggestions. But the big statement that was there was that I was going to a meeting every day. Every day I was going to a meeting, even though I was using, and no one said to me, "Here's the door." But I did start to feel that I was a bit like the embarrassing relative in the rooms, because everyone's like, "Oh, he's going back down the pub again after the meeting. He's going to the off licence," and then a few people suggested I go to the other fellowship, you know, the drinking one. And I'm not dissing them. Without them, where would we be? But, you know, people were suggesting I go to AA. Now, I took that really personal. I thought they're embarrassed. I'm bad for NA's image. I'm bad for their reputation. There's all these people turning up and doing their bit and doing their service and sharing their strength and sharing their worries and just getting through life clean. And there's me coming along, you know, drunk. Or every time someone spoke to me, they'd say, "Hey," I'd say, "Yeah, I'm clean," because I really believed I was clean. To me, my denial was the drugs, and you could see people, you know, people clean can really smell booze off you, you know. So I'm so glad I kind of rock bottomed in them 90 days, because what I've just shared with you isn't an NA recovery message. It's someone going to NA, trying to do it their way, and not surrendering. A little bit about my youth before I'd got to the NA thing. It's a bit all over the place, but we'll go with the flow. We'll be okay. I was addicted to fantasy. You know, my mother and father, they did the best that they could, but I was the eldest. We moved a lot. As a child, I didn't realise how that affected my security. I had an uncle who was a paedophile. He interfered with me. He interfered with, as we got older, nobody spoke about it, but he was blanked out of the family. But as we got older, I'd be at family gatherings and other cousins. I'd found out this sick man had interfered with half of my cousins as well. So I carried that, but I didn't think that's what was wrong with me. I just, like I said to you, I just tried to escape into comfort and feeling good. So eventually, you know, I kind of messed up my schooling with drinking. We emigrated. We moved to Ireland for 3 years, and I really learned how to drink there. And then we came back to London, and I had a bit of an identity that I could knock back the booze. And my mates were just leaving school, you know, and they were starting to drink, and you know, and I could really knock back the booze. And it's sad, but it was like a bit of an identity for me. I vouched that I'd never take grade A drugs, and I didn't know anyone who took grade A drugs at the time. I just thought, you know, I just saw it on things like Kojak. You know, you take heroin and cocaine, you go to prison. But as the years went by, and following different kinds of music and stuff like that, different drugs came along with that. About 1979, in my area, I was living in Fulham. A few of my mates that used to be like really cool kids, they started becoming really disheveled and shady, and started getting prison sentences, and they were taking heroin, and they were getting it from, there'd been a revolution in Iran, and there was a lot of heroin in that part of London. And I just thought, well, I'll never get into that. I still like going to gigs, I still like stuff like that. But I hated going to work on a Monday, and I hated, you know, waiting till Friday. I'd blow all my money, I'd get in a terrible state. It wasn't, you know, the person I am now is a different person to that person, but I didn't know any other way. So this went on for quite a while, and like I say, I messed up my education and everything. At school, you know when you're in the playground and you twirl around and you get dizzy? Well, we used to do that in the playground. And what would happen is the teacher would ring the bell, and then everyone would stop in the playground, and they'd go back up the school to the, you know, these great old Victorian buildings. And there'd be Tony in the playground still twirling around, and I'm getting dizzy, I'm getting out of my head. So I know I'm an addict. I know that for me, drugs was an escape from reality, an escape from how I was feeling. Getting back to the NA thing, this went on for a while. I was looking at a prison sentence. I was probably going to get, in them days, you could get fucking, I swore, sorry, Dane. Yeah. you could get about 3 years for having a gram of smack or a couple of grams of smack. 3 years. I mean, that was really, really harsh. And I got busted. So I knew I was going to prison. My girlfriend had her family had stepped in. It was one of them things where I thought we were like Sid and Nancy. You know, that kind of fantasy. I thought we were like Sid and Nancy. Or like, you know, Edie Sedgwick and Joe D'Alessandro out of something out of the, you know, the New York Velvet Underground. This, you know, I was ducking and diving up the White City Estate. But in my head, oh yeah, we're like Sid and Nancy, two romantic junkies. I thought it was really cool. And my family found out. I still get bits of guilt and shame about what I must have put them through. I feel very fortunate that my mother had me back for 22 years as a son. I was 22 years clean when she died from cancer. I was with her when she passed. And then my father, he had 26 years of me clean. And they were the best years that I had with my mother and father. And even with my siblings now, I'm the big brother that I'm not the one that is causing the problems. My father had two heart attacks in the 80s, and I wasn't there at the hospital to see him off, to see him. He didn't go, but it was in the 80s. But what he said on the second time was, he said to my mum, look, if I don't make it, he said, I know you'll be okay, and I know the rest of them will be okay, but he said, the one I'm worried about is the big fella. And because he's an old Irishman, he used to call me the big fella. I was the eldest. So they were really, really worried. Me and my girlfriend, I did a dreadful thing once. I stayed at my mum and dad's house, and they found the top of a needle in the bathroom. Now I'm in bed, I'm out of my nut. Next thing, the lights have come on, the old man's come in, pulled a duvet off me. You're using drugs, I just found this, blah, blah, blah. And I said, no. And he said, show me your arm. So I put out this arm, and it was nothing, spotless. And he didn't ask to see the other arm, and that was like a dartboard. And he said, I want it. And I said, well, it's Katie, Dad. She's got a problem. So it was a real ratty thing to do, but I blame her. She's got a problem. And I know it was the same with her family. Her mother and father blame me, and that's the way parents can be. I understand that. So all of this was going on, and I went into a detox. My DDU unit refused to see me. I was getting free methadone, and I couldn't even get it together to go and get the methadone. I couldn't get, you know, I couldn't even get up and go and get sign on. I was just, it wasn't like I'd given up on life, but I made no effort. The only thing I could do was go and score or try and get the money to score. As long as I've got that, I'll be fine. So, I know it feels like a bit like a drug CV, but if there's a people here that are new to this, they need to know, you know, that they're not alone. This is kind of what gets you here. They said to me, look, you know, we think you need help. You need to go to a detox. And I said, well, I'm not really using heroin now. And please give me my methadone. And I only drink wine occasionally. And I said, well, what do you drink? I said, oh, maybe a bottle a day. And they said, well, what kind of wine? And I said, Thunderbird. And that's fortified wine. And I didn't realise that. I just thought, you know, I'm civilised. I drink wine. They refused. And I had to go into detox. I was about 25. I'd lost a couple of friends already. You know, it just didn't seem right. You know, what friends of mine were dying at that age and younger. And it was all kind of, I suppose, self-inflicted because of the lifestyle we lived. And I've gone into this detox, this great big Victorian building. It was like something out of a Hammer horror movie. It used to be called Tooting Beck Hospital. It was a really old hospital. They knocked it down, but it was a mental hospital. And anyway, when I got to the gates, they said I had to sign in that I was mental, a mental patient. And I thought, well, I'm not a mental patient. I'm a junkie. I actually think I'm quite a cool junkie. I like good music. I know some cool people who are also junkies and used to be somebody, you know. And they said, well, you're not coming in if you don't sign mental. So I am mental. I had to sign that. And I got in there and I learned more about drugs, you know, and I learned about drugs I'd never taken before. And I was the prize patient. You know, I left there, and as soon as I left there, I thought, right, I can have weekend use-ups, control my habit. 18 months later, I was back in there with my tail between my legs, asking for help. Please take me back. And I didn't have that kind of confidence leaving there. I knew it was over. I knew it was over. I was hitting 27, and there'd been overdoses myself. I'd woke up in blackouts with needles in all parts of my legs and everything. And how did that happen? So I knew it was over. And what happened was, I think I was open-minded enough that they did H&I. And NA came in. So I went to an NA meeting, you know, dragged my feet in. The nurses said to us, look, these people come here every Sunday, they're giving up their Sundays to come, you know, just give them an hour of your time, otherwise we're turning off EastEnders. Because we used to all cuddle up on the sofas, the TV was high up on the wall watching the rerun of EastEnders. So I went in there with an attitude, and two people shared. One of them was an East End barrel boy. I had really identified with him straight away, his humour and everything, and I connected with him. And then another guy shared, and he was really, really posh, and he was like a bit like an aristocrat. And I thought, how am I going to connect with him? And when he said that he'd been putting on balaclavas and holding up chemists, I was like, what? You know, and I thought, how can you hold up the chemist with that accent, you know? And, okay, how did I, you know, that kind of thing. So it wasn't like I was at a movie or being entertained, but I connected. I connected with the hope and the strength, and the humour was so important. I forgot that how crazy the situations are that we get into, and when you tell like normal people, that they're like, really, you know. I'll cut back to getting into NA, but that humour. I had a situation last year. I got through cancer, prostate cancer. I got through it. I didn't know if I was going to see the year through, and it was a dreadful year. One of my best friends committed suicide. A guy who gave me my first job clean. He emigrated to New Zealand. I'd spoken to him on Instant Messenger a couple of weeks before, and he committed suicide. And I got really, really ill with the stress and the grieving and the anxiety. And I had to go to the doctor about this thing that was starting to develop into possible prostate cancer. And I said, look, you know, do you think stress can cause a lot of problems, you know? And she said, yeah, you've been stressed recently? And I said, yeah. I said, a friend of mine committed suicide. She said, that would lead to stress. And she said, have you ever thought of suicide? And I said, well, no, not yet. And I just said it like that, like you would to people in NA. And she went... and started writing it down. So I forget how we talk in here. Sometimes when you talk to civilians, they kind of, it throws them a little, because we do have that kind of dark humour. Anyway, so I'd got out of detox, and now I knew I had somewhere to go. And I came on my own. I didn't come with a gang out of detox. I came on my own. Penny remembers my first sponsor was Grateful Robert. I got him because he sponsored my friend. He was a great sponsor at that time for me, and he got me involved in NA, and he told me about conventions, and I made tea at one of the biggest meetings in London at the time, because I just wanted to keep busy. I was too scared to talk to people, but one of the best commitments, if you want to talk to people, is make them a cup of tea. So I started getting used to NA, and basically I went to a New Year's Eve dance, and you know, in them days the parties were quite small and everyone got fed, and Acid House was just coming out, and we were clean doing Acid House, which is quite mad. But and I noticed in the dance everyone was dancing and everything, and you know, and I looked over and I saw, oh, Dudley, bless his soul. I thought, that's that guy off the telly. I know him, Lovejoy, you know. And And then I saw girls dressed up, and it was a duck, and I went over to do my moves with the girls, and they kind of backed off. And I wasn't used to that. You know, I was used to being got the Shebeens, and, you know, when you fancied someone, you got nearer and nearer, and you had a little dance. It wasn't quite like that in NA. But it was, I'm clean. And I got to my meeting the next day, and I put my hand up, and the whole meeting, it was like they clapped. They were really, really happy for me, because I wasn't getting it. And they were so happy for me. I was a day clean. And then this guy came up to me who never gave up on me. And, you know, he said to me, well done. I said, look, do you think, you know, yeah, but maybe in 10 years I can drink. He said, well, wait till 10 years, see what happens. Now, what he did, he didn't mean to do it, but he planted a seed in me. And I thought, oh, well, you know, 10 years, I could get my life back together. Maybe I can drink again. So 9.5 years clean, my relationship is breaking up. A bit, my business doing something that I really, really loved. You know, you know when you get one of them jobs, if you get one, it's that you go to bed early Sunday night, and you get up early on a Monday because you really love your job. That business is falling apart, and now I've got this little reservation. I'm nearly 10 years clean. Maybe I can drink now. And I declare I had to. I had to put my hands up. I've been working the steps, doing service, sponsoring people, always had a sponsor, but I planted that seed. When if I can get to 10 years clean, then, you know, I deserve a drink. Not that I'm going to have one. And I declared it, and I never drank, and I stayed clean. I do sometimes miss drinking. I lost a lovely auntie in February. She gave me my first place to live clean. I had to get out of Shepherd's Bush. She had a lovely house in North London, and I moved in there, and I was doing my meetings regularly. I was getting on the Northern Line. They used to call it the Misery Line. I was going to meetings all over London. And but when we went to, she moved back to Ireland, and we got over there, And I must say, there was a lot of love and laughter at the funeral, and the drink looked nice. You know, it looked really inviting. My sister had her 25th wedding anniversary last week. I was at that, and they're the times that I do miss having a drink, because you're with family and you're with loved ones. But I just have to forward it, you know. My father, bless his soul, he used to say to me for the first few years in recovery, but can't you have a pint, you know, at Christmas time? She said, Jesus, you can have a pint at Christmas. And I said, I can't, Dad, I can't. Why not? You know, like that. And I said, well, I'll get back to the way I was before. I went, oh, no, don't bother then, you know. So they knew, they respected that. My mother, bless her soul, she took a while to get this NA thing. She thought, this is a phase. How long before he goes? How long before? And I found out that when I was living in North London, when I was going to meetings, she used to phone my aunt, how is he? How is he? How's he doing? What do you reckon? And my auntie just said to her, well, he can be a bit down sometimes, but I don't know what happens. He goes to them meetings and he comes back and he has a real spring in his step and he's really upbeat. And this is what I'm saying to you about, you know, stay tuned into this, the maintenance. How many times I can't speak for you. How many times have I not wanted to go to a meeting because I'm tired, because of personalities, because a girl that I was obsessed with doesn't want me and she's with that guy that I don't like? How many times have I looked at reasons not to go to a certain meeting, and then when I've got there, a couple of hugs, a little share up, you connect, you know, you maybe go out to eat after, do more fellowship. And, you know, long may that keep going. So it got back to me in later years that, you know, about that. And she never really acknowledged my recovery, that she was glad I was back in the fold and everything. But I could tell she was anxious. For me, I think anxiety is a bully. And I can be plagued by that bully anxiety. And I think my mother had a lot to deal with and worry about us. And what happened was, I was in a relationship with a girl and it ended, and I think they thought he's going to go. I really loved this girl. I would have married her, to be honest with you, if she'd have had me. But it broke my heart. And what happened was, the phone kept going and kept going and kept going. And my mother turned around, and she's like a civilian, an outsider. We do this all the time. We're ringing each other, you know. You can talk. Oh, I felt this. I felt that. You know. Blah blah blah. And she just said, "You've got really good friends today." All right. What do you mean, Mum? She goes, "Well, that shower of shit that you used to be with, they wouldn't be ringing you every minute to see if you were okay after." And I thought, yeah, this is rubbing off the NA thing. And my NA birthday falls on my real birthday. And I didn't plan it that way. I didn't know about anniversaries. But getting back to that day clean when the whole meeting was happy with me, I now decided that I could go out across West London and I could... it's fine for you lot, but I need to get some of my friends in here. Some of my friends are in a bit of trouble. So I'd go around people's houses that were using, you know, and they'd be cooking up in front of me, and I'd have my key rings. And they'd say, "You look well, Tone." "Yeah, I'm doing NA. It's great. We get all these key rings, and you get rounds of applause, and there's loads of people there, and there's even famous people there. And it's like, and there's all walks of life, and it's really interesting." "Yeah, sweet, Tone." And then they'd have a hit. And I'd be like, I can't 12-step these people. I've got to go and 12-step somewhere else. All on my own. My mate's now coming out of detox. I said, "Look, you've got to come to NA. It's great." "All right, Tone, I'll meet you some." We met in a pub. Bad start. And he ordered a pint. I'm 7 days clean. He said, "Do you want a pint?" I went, Yeah, I deserve a pint. I haven't had one for 7 days. Yeah, it'd be lovely, a pint of lager." So I've knocked the pint back, tasted lovely as it did. And then his wife turned up to meet him after he's come out of detox, the same detox I was in. She gives him a look, he gives her the look. I know the look, I'm going with them. And I'm back in the house and I've got my drug of choice in my arm. And I left that house desperate, crying. I know what's coming. I know what's coming. The habit's coming. The lifestyle's coming. I've had that much NA. And it worked for 7 days. And it worked for the 90 days that I didn't get nicked. Didn't get owe anyone any money. Didn't have dealers after me. Was able to actually look for a job. That sort of stuff. I went to a meeting that night in Ladbroke Grove. And it wasn't much bigger than this. And I shared, and I was stoned, but I shared. And I shared that I don't want to use. I'm desperate. I've used today, but I don't want this back. And there were men in there, grown men, that were so moved by my sharing that they were welling up. And one guy shared, and he was crying for me. He didn't even know me. He was crying for my pain. He was crying for my desperation. He was crying for my, "I've no hope. What am I going to do with my life? How am I going to get clean?" And I got home that night, and I'd been fighting it all day. And of course, you know, then I started dribbling and I was gone. But then the next day I got up and I went to a meeting, and I never ever used after that. And that was the day before my real birthday. So when I got to a year clean, I had my real birthday and my NA birthday at the same time. So every year my mother would give me a birthday card and I'd say, "Yeah, but Mum, I'm another year clean." So didn't really pay much notice. And then when I got to 20 years clean, she sent me my birthday card and she said, "And congratulations, thank you. Congratulations on your clean time." And I was like, yes. She believes this thing. And I was with her when she took her last breath. And that kills me. Because it was almost like it was meant to be, because we were doing the rounds, you know, we were doing the rounds, one in, one out. And I think she chose to leave with me. I really do. I believe that. And when my father passed, I missed him passing. But all the others that weren't with my mum, they were there. And I think that was meant to be. I really do. Because I think my dad thought, he'll be all right. You know, he's on his way up to the hospice. And he was with his mother and the rest are here. So, yeah. So, sponsors, first sponsor, we became friends. I moved on to another sponsor. That sponsor emigrated. My third sponsor passed away clean. the relationship where that caused me a lot of pain and I didn't use, and it took me 7 years to get over her. I felt embarrassed about that, you know. Oh, yeah, man, you got to get, you know, I don't know, you know. But it took me 7 years to get over her, even with flings and casual things. And with my third sponsor, why I'd got him, I'd been with a girl and I could feel, when that ended, she left me, I could feel it was going into 2 years and I'm still thinking about her and obsessing about her. And I thought, I can't do this to myself. I'm sponsoring myself because my sponsor had emigrated. And I went and got this man to sponsor me because I thought, I'm sponsoring myself on what I've got left in the bank. I'm on my overdraft. I'm being sponsored by a madman, me. So he took me on and he really, and we nipped it in the bud. You know, I didn't want to go through that again. But three things that he taught me as a little mantra was speak my truth, mind my own business, and have fun. And I'm still working on the mind my own business, but I'm getting there. You know, it's not my business, not my business. I have to keep telling myself when start, you know, it's not my business. So I've now got another sponsor. He's not, because I'm getting older, they're not getting much older than me, but he's got more time than me, and that's important for me. And I want to do a written step 11 with him, because when I came around, I think the literature is fantastic now. Even the step guides of the questions, the details. We had a few bits of stuff here and there, and step 11 was all a bit wishy-washy. Oh, well, I believe in God, you know, all that stuff. And I really want to do a step 11 with him. So that's where I'm at around that. I want to do a written one. So I'm kind of working on that. I've got personal problems at the moment that I deal with either in my home group from the floor or with my, you know, my people and my sponsor, and I'm not happy with my job. Big deal, high class problem, right? But it's causing me a lot of misery. And I try with being clean to treat myself the way I would try and treat someone that I love, or any guidance I would give to a friend. I try to look like, you know, work that for myself. I'm going to end, but there's just one thing. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. When I was born, when I was a baby, you know, when babies get so fun and they're meant to get up and they're supposed to take their first couple of steps. Now I've gone well past that stage and I'm still crawling around, and my mother was really, really worried. She thought, oh my God, my first child, he's a cripple, he's deformed. So she told me this a few years before she died. It was really, we had some real intimate moments, clean, because when I was younger it was always about me. But as I got older, I got to know my family more. And so they took me to the doctor, and there's something wrong with him, he won't walk, he's just crawling, he drags himself from one end of the room to the other. And the doctor went over me, he said, there's nothing wrong with him, he's just lazy. that's something about me, you know. So that's, there was something else I was going to say, drying up. It's gone. Maybe it's meant to be. I hope I've helped someone. I've got it. I'll be brief. Recovery, life can be boring. You know, going to work, paying your bills, doing your bins, blah, blah, blah. If you are around and you're struggling with stuff and, you know, and you're doing it, try and get a hobby or a passion, because I think it's really, really important. You know, something that really, that you feel passionate about, and doesn't matter if you make money out of it or not, that you just really enjoy. I think it's really important, and get yourself a higher power, it doesn't matter what, but you know, that thing that represents love and kindness. And that's my little tip for the day: hobbies, passion, and a higher power. And thanks, that's it. Thank you.